Willkommen bei Zaren, Daten, Fakten.
Вы говорите по-русски? Kann noch jemand Russisch?
Говорит Москва.
Russland ist ein Rätsel. Innerhalb eines Geheimnisses, umgeben von einem Mysterium.
A warm welcome to a new episode of the Zaren, Daten, Fakten podcast. In this podcast, we talk about the Russian economy. And today we are joined once again by Ben Aris, the editor and founder of BNE IntelliNews. Ben, time is really flying. The year is already 20% over. So now is at least a good time to ask your perspective. What do you expect? What does BNE IntelliNews expect for the Russian economy in 2024 when it comes to the GDP, the growth, or the downturn maybe? What about inflation and what about the deficit in Russia in 2024?
Yeah, it's very difficult to predict, isn't it? So the budget results just come out. And I'm just about to write a piece, look at the budget again. And maybe that's a good place to start. Because if you remember in this, the first quarter of last year, the budget, the deficit blew out massively to 1.7 trillion rubles deficit. And everyone was cheering because the twin sanctions had just come in December and January on oil, and it looked like they were working. They looked like the Russia was going to run out of money. And the oil revenues also collapsed on the back of the oil product sanctions, which came in February 5th last year. And then what happened? The year went on. Actually, at the time, we did a podcast with Chris Weaver and Chris Rule, two of the best oil analysts on Russia, been doing it for decades. And they were saying, no, hold back. It's an aberration. It's not clear. But Sulianov, the finance minister, also said, no, it's a readjustment. We're changing the way we tax oil because of the sanctions, and the oil revenues will cover. And so we wrote that story. And that's exactly what happened. And then by May or June, the Russian budget was back in profit. And by the end of the year, Russia was making huge amounts of money. The current account surplus in 2022 was 200 and whatever it was, 38. Last year, it fell to 51. But the budget deficit was expected to be something or anything between 3 and 4%, up to some people were saying 12% deficit. And that would have been a disaster. And the end of the year, it came in at 1.9, very comfortable, easy to finance. And growth was just shocking. It was good. It was 3.6. And if you look across the board, the big indicators, Russia's growing strongly, investment is up, capacity utilization is an all-time high, incomes are rising. So 2023, it was a strong year. What's going to happen this year? It seems that the Russian economy is starting to max out. And that capacity utilization number, that, you know, there's no more factory space left to make things. And so you can't get any growth. You've hit the ceiling. The deficit that's just been reported is already at about 1.6, 1.9% of GDP. The deficit forecast is about, again, about 1.9 trillion rubles. And the cumulative deficit is 1.5 already. So in that sense, we're in the same place as we were last year with very large deficit. But the difference between this year and last year is that oil revenues are extremely strong as a function of the fact that oil's gone back to $85. And Russia has completely dodged all of the oil sanctions. They've had virtually no impact. As the oil price cap regime is supposed to stop Russia from being able to sell oil over $60. And as far as we can see, not a single barrel has been sold for less than $60. They've been a complete failure, which is a problem for the West. The US now is playing whack-a-mole. It's sanctioning individual ships, individual shipping companies in order to try and make that work. And there are reports that India, for example, is starting to turn Russian oil ships away. But they'll find a new judge. They'll just send them to some intermediate country. Senegal's an option. China's still taking it. You've got the whole of Southeast Asia, which hasn't got much oil from Russia. You can just send it there and then they can send it to India. And this game of whack-a-mole will continue. And all that does is it drives up the cost of producing it. But Russia's not particularly interested in the profitability of its oil business. It's just interested in the revenues, earning enough money to pay for the war machine. And that will continue as far as I can see. As for growth, because we've hit this ceiling, there's no more sort of capacity to use, and there are no more people to use as well. Russia's economy now, the labor market is extremely tight. Unemployment's down to whatever it is, 2.9, which is about as low as it can go. And that, of course, eats into domestic production for everything else. So there's not much growth there. So growth is expected to slow to something like 2%. But even 2% is a huge achievement, because given the new constraints on the economy, the economic growth potential of the Russian economy is something really small, like 0.3, 0.5. And it was 1.5 before the war, which was also bad because of the lack of investment that's been going on for years as Putin channeled all the money he could into building this fiscal fortress. So 2% is running well ahead of what Russia should be able to do. The economy's running hot. And that creates the one really big problem that the economy has. Everything else is going swimmingly, but it's inflation, because you're running the economy too hot and inflation's up 7.4, 7.5, which forced Nabulina at the central bank to hike rates to 16%, which is a crushingly high rate. And there's no way she can cut the rates, because it's not actually a monetary problem that the rates have an effect on, but she has to keep them high to keep the undermounts. And that will cool the economy as well. And there's no real prospect for her being able to cut rates until we come out the other side of the war and we go back to a sensible economy, which isn't being driven hell for leather to produce as many arms as possible. But so on the economic point of view, but they can keep this up for a couple of years. The budget deficit, 1.9, is Russia doesn't usually run deficits, and it is at the moment, because the other part of the budget numbers that came out is while all revenues are up, so is spending, and spending is up even more than the oil revenues, because they're just pumping every kopeck they have into arms production. And so the deficits will be under control. The Tsulianov is saying that the deficit's actually expected to come in at not 1.9% this year, but 0.8. And the financing of that is going to be, it's comfortable. Again, the National Welfare Fund, the rainy day fund they used to cover budget deficits, was 6.8 trillion rubles at the start of last year, and they spent down 2 trillion rubles of that, but there's still 4.8. trillion rubles in the fund. And so the deficit is 1.9 trillion rubles. They've got enough money in the fund to cover the deficit for this year, next year, probably the year after. And that's before they tap the liquidity in the banking sector. And there's another 17 trillion rubles. And that's just before they put taxes on. And so there's lots of options. They can actually fund this war for decades at this sort of level. And I don't think the West, nor especially not Ukraine, which is running out of money already, can keep that up. And looking down the road a bit, I think that's Putin's strategy.
Let's focus on something that you said, that Russia can go on for some years at the current trajectory, economic trajectory. I heard earlier estimations that Russia can go on like maybe 2 years, 3 years in the current form, in the current spending spree. But now you mentioned a decade, and some other people also are constantly shifting the time horizon, how sustainable the current model is for Russia. How many years can Russia spend more than it takes in money? And you mentioned all the other ways how Russia could actually improve the tax base and so on, or get more money in. The main question is, are the sanctions over this time frame, over 5 years or 10 years, as long as Russia can go on, are the sanctions hurting more or less is the effect of the sanctions stronger, getting stronger, or is it getting weaker over the years?
I think the first thing to say is one of the big miscalculations, the enormous miscalculations, has been the quality of the economic management, financial management of the Russian team. They really have done a spectacular job. Not that's a good thing, but that everyone was convinced that cutting Russia off from the dollar, the SWIFT sanctions, and seizing the central bank's reserves, which came completely out of left field, that was not even discussed before the war, were going to crush and cause the Russian economy to collapse. And it just simply didn't happen. There was a couple of months at the beginning where it was touch and go, but the capital controls plus saw that off very effectively. The other thing with the, I think the quality of the reporting and analysis is also pretty thin, because everyone's looking simply at the budget deficits and assuming that because Russia's been cut off from the international capital markets, has trouble raising money abroad, that would be enough to scupper the Kremlin. But it ignores the money in the banking sector. I see that barely mentioned. And that's a huge pool of liquidity, admittedly in rubles, but it's enormous. And they can tap it. The problem for Russia would be if there's an oil price crash, and that would cut it off from the income it gets from the oil exports. And that's another aspect, is people are looking at the current account surplus deficit as the source of money to Russia. So in the last 2 years, Russia's exported a total of about $650 billion worth of oil. And in 2022, oil wasn't sanctioned, and so it earned that money through the existing system, and that came back to the Kremlin. And the current account surplus in 2022 was about $260 billion, which actually ended up in Kremlin coffers. What changed in 2023 was the sanctions came in, and so all of the oil was transferred to the shadow. And these ships are sort of nominally Russian, but they're all flying under Liberian flags, and Guyanese flags, and what have you. And the current account last year fell to $50 billion. But not only are the identities of the ships being hidden, the companies that are buying and selling the oil using these ships are also in offshore havens, opaque. And if you look at $650 billion were earned over 2 years. In the first year, we had about 260 come into Russia. In the second year, we had 50 come in. Where did the other $200 billion go? They went into these companies controlled by the shadow fleets. And what we've got here is a slush fund is being built up. And all that money is just not returning to Russia. And as I said, the tax system had to be changed completely because Russians in 2022 were just paying through the existing system. And the beginning of 2023, Semyonov said out loud, I have to rebuild the system in order to, because all the money's disappeared down a rabbit hole. We don't know where it is. It's gone into this opaque systems. But of course, the Kremlin is well aware of how much oil each company is producing, how much they're exporting. So they know who's got the money. They don't know necessarily where it is, but they do know who's got it. And so there's a slush fund of what we estimate at least $150 billion. That's half of all the central bank's money that was frozen. And that could well be up to $200 billion now. They're sitting around in offshore accounts. And all that money is nominally not Russian. And it can be used to buy imports, tech that they're missing, equipment that they're missing, all the things that have been sanctioned. And the whole global South are willing partners, is the so-called friendly nations. They're willing to be intermediary. And we've seen goods flooding through Turkey, through the UEA, Kyrgyzstan in particular, car exports to the UK, from the UK to Kyrgyzstan are up like 5,000%. It's a huge importer of Mercedes. Apparently, Bishkek is now full of class A, top-end Mercedes saloons, which, you know, if you've been to Bishkek, it isn't. That's all going to Russia. So if we talk about the sanctions, I've already said that the oil sanctions have failed completely because they've just managed really impressively to completely reorientate the entire oil export to Asia from Europe. Just takes 4 months to get there instead of 2 weeks. On the technology sanctions, that's also failed. And that was the one that the West really should have been able to enforce, because it's Germany, America, Japan, Taiwan control all the key technology, the really high-end stuff. And yet they've been selling to intermediaries. And that last year, Russia imported more tech and chips than it did from before the war. So technology sanctions have failed. And what does that leave? They're trying to do some smart sanctions now, but these things like aluminium's been targeted. Lubricant, specialist lubricant oil that you need to run high-end machines has been targeted. LNG production equipment, that's dominated by two or three companies, Canadian, American. That one's had a bit more bite, but none of these things affect the economy in big numbers. They affect very specific Arctic LNG projects being affected. Day to day, it doesn't affect. We're in this game of whack-a-mole where the West is now trying to be more effective, find sanctions that actually work. But you're dealing with a wet bar of soap here. As soon as you find something that works, it just slips out of your hand and they find a way around. And a way of putting it is that you have to spend a lot of political capital in order to enforce these sanctions, but because you need to lean on third countries that are not necessarily your allies in order to enforce them, to crack down. And you're spending political capital that's slow and difficult and expensive. And all the Russians need to spend is money. They just offer discounts. They offer great deals. And poor countries like Kyrgyzstan are making buckets of profits out of this. And they're not going to say no to them. And the same, anywhere you go in the global south, they're largely much poorer companies and they're just taking this as a windfall. And they don't even have to send it straight to Russia. They can just send it to their neighbor and then daisy chains. The EU did a report recently and they think the typical transport chain from the West to Russia involves 50 counterparties, 50. And you try and police that. It's impossible.
Some days ago, we got a very interesting number in. Because the Russian budget or the Russian state will have a cash income of around 52.5 billion rubles for 2024. They calculate with this number. This is 12% more than last year. And when we compare the number with 21, it was 33 billion. So it really went up. The tax income in the last 3 years nearly doubled, not doubled, but like 70, 80% more nowadays. How is this possible even? What is going on there?
This is, for me, this is one of the great ironies of this war, is what it's done is it's because everyone now is counting their pennies. It's forced on Russia a lot of the really deep structural reforms that is always ignored. I've written lots of stories about corruption, particularly in things like construction, and no one really cared. The cost of building a kilometer of road in Germany is $5 million. In Russia, it's 50. But at the end of the day, the Russians spend the money and $45 is stolen. But you get the road at the end of the day. And the thing is, the subsidy of the oil and gas exports means that there's plenty of money that you can afford to do all this corruption because you still get your roads, your investment. What's changed is suddenly that $45 is suddenly key. And it started, the tax system has already been through a revolution under Mistushin, who's now prime minister, and he put in a new IT system. And even before the war, the tax take, because of that reform Mistushin made, the tax take went up 20%, while the tax burden only went up 2%. And now under Silyanov, this whole necessity to be efficient has become absolutely crucial. And so what they've been doing is they've been going through all of the tax code, all of the systems with fine-tooth comb and improving and making it more efficient. This IT reform has been significant because Russia now has one of the most advanced tax online systems in the world, where everything is online. The cash register and the produkty at the bottom of the road is directly linked into the computers of Ministry of Finance. And if you buy something in a store using a card or it goes through the cash register, then you as a Russian individual can actually look up your own tax record and find that purchase listed where you have paid so much VAT. And it's this efficiency that just doesn't exist in the West. We're generations behind in this. And they're making use of that in order to crack down on all the scams, in order to increase the tax take. But the tax is a very interesting one because Putin's now said in the run-up to the elections just gone that they're going to introduce a progressive income tax. And this again hasn't caught much attention in the coverage, but this is a revolution too, because the first thing Putin, the very first he did when he took office 23 years ago, was that he introduced flat tax, 13%. And he hasn't touched that in all the time since and didn't dare to. And it's one of the things the Russians love. It's like an extremely low income rate. But the thing is that 13% applies to the babushka next door as it does to the oligarchs. They pay the same. And now that they're on the hunt for more revenue, they're finally going to start and introduce progressive rate, which means, of course, the bulk of the population will remain at 13%. But if you earn $100,000 a year equivalent, or whatever it is, we don't know the details yet, then now you're going to have to start paying more tax, which is long overdue, because letting the oligarchs off with 13% it's obviously stupid. But it's part, as I say, of this ongoing reform. They're looking at like ways to increase the taxes. They've already taken the top sort of 40 biggest state-owned companies who are paying extra tax. Again, details are secret. We don't know. They're doing it gently, and they'll do it without touching the bulk of the population for as long as they can. Because the one thing they have done in all those years is put VAT up by 2%. That was that 2% increase. And that was extremely unpopular. Yeah. But they pushed it through in the middle of the World Cup as well, actually. It was like nicely timed.
Let's talk about the central bank reserves. More and more people are talking about using the income generated by the interest rates of the central bank reserves. We had a guest on the show some weeks ago, Philip Pilkington, Irish finance guy, and he said he doesn't even know if it's possible to take the interest of the Russian central bank and give it to another country or use this money in a different way. So what is your take on this whole situation with the $300 billion that is frozen apparently? Is this possible to take it? Is it possible to take the interest that is accumulated by these $300 billion, what effects will it have? So this is a major question right now, what to do with the Russian central bank reserves.
You have to divide this question up into two aspects. One is the moral aspect and one is the legal aspect. The moral aspect is Russia is morally responsible for rebuilding it. The problem is that the amount of money that's needed. So the physical damage in Ukraine is at least 150. The latest World Bank for the larger costs is around $480 billion. I talked to Jaresko, the former finance minister, and she said that if you took everything into account, it's about $1 trillion. Where are you going to get $1 trillion? Where are you going to get half a trillion dollars from in order to pay? The answer is nowhere. This is another practical aspect of the problem, is that there's nowhere to get this money from. The international financial organizations, they're good for 20, 30, 50 billion maybe. The EU and US are not going to pay for that because it's taxpayers' money. And why should you put $500 billion into somebody else's country? You can't borrow it. It's too much. And so the current official plan is to get the private sector to pay for it through investments. But having talked to investors looking at Ukraine, they're not going to do it. They'll do it when the country's booming, but they're not going to do the rebuild because the risks are too huge. So really your only alternative is to take central banks' money and the Russian money. the legal aspects of it, look, it's never been done. It's never been done before where us, the West, who have sanctioned a country, attacked a country, where central bank reserves have been frozen regularly. But the problem is legally, because of our own strong property rights rules, is that money remains the property of the sovereign state, in this case, Russia. It's Russia's money. And that to take it would mean we have to, you know, completely ignore our own rules. And people said, oh, this is just a legalistic excuse. But if you think the basis of financial system, money, banks, is trust.
It's 1 o'clock.
If your depositors at a bank don't trust your bank, then they take their money out of the bank, has a run, it collapses. And that works at sovereign level too. The only legal way you can take the central bank money is if we're at war. At an individual level, it's if you're convicted of a criminal charge, then your money can be confiscated. It's easy to freeze. It's very difficult to confiscate, take ownership. And at a sovereign level, you have to declare war on Russia, which is something everyone's been adamant from the very first day that the West is not going to declare war on, which leaves you in an impossible situation. And so everyone's been trying to find wheezes to avoid this problem. The Americans have actually taken a very aggressive line, and they're just like, let's ignore the law and just take it. And they've passed laws in the States which allows them to seize, and which means own, the $5 billion of Russian money that's there. And they're pushing very hard for the West to do that. And this is one of the reasons, I think, why they cut Ukraine off, was to put pressure on Europe to say, look, we're not going to pay for it, and you haven't got enough money, so you have to take this central bank money. But the EU is extremely reluctant to do it, because it undermines the European financial system, and it also undermines the euro, because lots of people have their money on deposit, other sovereigns in Europe, because it's nice, solid, and safe, alternative to the US system.
And not just talking about the legality, but also talking about the practicability. Is it possible to take the money that the central bank has saved somewhere? It's some number, right, in the system. And take this money and, for example, build a highway in another country. Is this possible? Does it work like that? I think the claim of Pilkington in the podcast was that it is basically not possible to take the money that the central bank has saved somewhere and use this money to build infrastructure or something like that. So,
well, it's a question of exposure in so much as that there's been two suggestions that are half workable. One is to use the central bank money as collateral to borrow and then give that to Ukraine. But the problem with that is that exposes you to the risk. If you use central bank money as collateral, you haven't touched it, it's still there. And then you go and do your investment and everything goes tickety-boo, then there's no problem. You can pay back your loan and everything's fine. The problem is if there's some sort of disaster, and then you have to, and then that time you have to use the collateral to repay the loan, then you've taken the Russian money. So it's a sort of moral hazard situation that, and of course, you can't take the Russian money because it's not yours, which means that the sovereign states, the West basically, ends up having to pay it back themselves. So they don't want to go there. The other suggestion was to take the interest that's being earned on these investments, most in Europe there and sovereign bonds and the like, and to use that and send it to Ukraine. And there the legal wheeze would be to tax it, to introduce special taxes. And that actually looks like a viable alternative, because you have the power to tax this money and then it becomes yours legally. And as far as I know, I think Borrell just said in the last day or two that the EU signed off on this idea. But the trouble with that scheme is that these investments, this 300 billion, and something on the order of about 3 to 5 billion a year. So useful money, send it to Ukraine. It's absolutely what they need. Ukraine currently is running a current account deficit of $5 billion a month. So it's a drop in the ocean. It doesn't solve anything. It just creates a little bit of extra money. So I think we're really stuck with this. And I think this issue of funding Ukraine's war ongoing is a complete headache. And funding the reconstruction is, I don't see how it's going to be done. I really think that at the end of the war, Ukraine are going to be left to fend for itself. It's going to get decent amounts of money, 10, 15 billion here and there, but it's going to get nothing like it needs to rebuild to where it was before. And so the country's going to be on its back for a generation while mums and pups build it up by hand from scratch as they go. So it's an awful situation.
We come already to the last question. And let's imagine that the current trajectory we're on is continuing for 10 years. In 10 years, we still have sanctions going on. How will the world look like in 10 years if the sanctions are continuing like they do right now? How is it looking for Russia? How do you see Russia in 10 years? The sanctions are in place, maybe tougher sanctions are introduced. And how do you also see the European Union? Let's focus on these two players. In the European Union, of course, we're the podcast of the German-Russian Chamber of Commerce. For us, it's very interesting. Germany, yeah. And also Russia. How do you see in 10 years, if we continue sanctions policy like it is right now, how will the world look like for these players?
Adding Europe into the equation makes it a much more interesting question. Look, from what I've been saying so far, I've been saying that Russia's it's in a strong position and we're basically hitting our heads against a brick wall and that Putin is going to continue his war with impunity for the next couple of years. However, in the long term, when the hot phase of the war dies down and we get into a frozen conflict, like Abkhazia or Northern Cyprus or some of these disputes that are still going and basically got forgotten about, then Russia's going to be hampered. The spending will go down to normal levels and the economy will go back to more or less normal. But with this huge shackle of sanctions around its feet. And at the moment, they're getting away with it because oil prices are high because of sanctions, and so Russia has extra money to spend. But if things go back to normal, then the profitability thing comes back into play. And Russia is now much less profitable. And so what we're looking at is stagnation, that Russia over the next decade will start to stagnate. And at the moment, it's the fastest growing of all of the developed markets. This is another testament how badly sanctions are working. From the G7, Russia is now the fastest growing a developed country in the world, whereas the rest of Europe's going into recession. But it'll fall back below the global average and it'll slowly go backwards. And for Putin, that's going to cause him problems long term, because when Russians see their quality of life failing to keep up with the rest of the world, politically, they'll become more and more unhappy. It's going to take decades for that process to play out. And the sanctions are not coming off. They're not going to come off in my lifetime, as far as I'm concerned. Once you put sanctions on, the Vannevar-Jackson sanctions that were put on in the 60s on the Soviet Union, it took whatever it was, 50 years to take those off again. And there's going to be no incentive to take the Russian sanctions off. So it's just going to have to live with them. For Putin, that means he needs to rebuild Russia's entire economic, foreign trade outlook and reorientate to the global south. And his bet is that the global south is growing very fast and that this will provide a nice lucrative market for him to work in, which is not actually a stupid bet at all, in so much as the global south, the emerging markets, are due to overtake the West in terms of nominal size, not just PPP size, sometime around 2050, next 25 years. So he's got 25 years to do that, and it's actually going to be playing with the wind at his back. But Europe, so the sanctions stay on Russia, that's actually as much a problem, if not bigger problem for Europe than it is for Russia. Because I'm saying Russia's going to stagnate, but Europe is already stagnating. And to what extent, particularly here we are in Germany, Germany's been in the front line. To what extent has Germany's economic model been permanently damaged? Just how important was that cheap energy? And also what it does to the euro. The exports based on producing high quality widgets with very cheap energy meant that there was this constant flow of cash into the EU from that, which is now stopped. And Europe remains input deficit. There's a deficit of energy, there's a deficit of metal, there's a deficit of coal, there's a deficit of chemicals, there's fertilizer, on and on and on. The list is very long. And I think this is another thing people have underestimated. And it's not actually clear what the situation is. Just how dependent is Europe on this huge cornucopia of very cheap, copious amounts of inputs, which have stopped and will not return? And I think here that as the situation continues to decay, unemployment rises, costs are going up, cost of living is going up, taxes are going up, which everyone assumes is temporary. But this, to me, it looks like it's permanent. And how is Europe going to, it's just either going to become poorer or we're going to find some sort of solution. So no, and there's lots of options. You can get the energy from renewables, but the import of the raw materials, I don't see how you're going to replace that, or at least the cost of them is going to go up. And so the whole Europe Inc. is suddenly become a lot less profitable than it was. And how that will play out politically, I think we're already seeing that in the rise of the right. European Parliament elections are coming up and the Greens are going to get thrown out. They may not even get past the 5% mandate. And at some point, someone's going to turn around and say, like Orban, like Fico, let's do a deal with Russia. That makes sense. Because the countries that still do business with Russia, like Hungary, like Slovakia, are going to start looking, standing out, being more profitable because they still have the cheap energy. So it's going to be, I thought when this war started that BNE, we spent time writing about Russia. I thought all future of BNE is over. I'm starting to realize that I've got 20 years of work ahead of me, digging through all the details of how this thing played out and how this massive restructuring is going to unfold.
Thank you very much for your time, Ben. And to watch how it will shake out the whole situation, I recommend the readers to check out the website BNE and Tele News. They can also follow you on Twitter. You're yes. BNE editor on Twitter.
Yes. And to give the magazine a plug, go to intellinews.com. to see the our coverage. We also have there on the right-hand side in a thing called Editor's Picks. If you click on that, you can sign up to our digest, our daily digest of the most important stories in the region. And I usually write a blog every day about what's going on, just ruminating about the latest stories. I encourage everyone to do that.
Yes, and we are also following with the podcast the situation, mostly in German language, but sometimes when you have great guests like Ben Aris, also in English. So thank you very much for your time once again.
Es war ein Vergnügen. Dankeschön.
Dieser Podcast wurde präsentiert von der Deutsch-Russischen Auslandshandelskammer. Die Deutsch-Russische Auslandshandelskammer ist mit 1000 Mitgliedern der größte ausländische Wirtschaftsverband in Russland.